Okay, so all right, let us continue where we left off. And we were looking at the sutta called the Apana Sutta. And it is this sutta that shows the connection between these five spiritual faculties and how they kind of all belong together and how they condition each other here. And we have looked through all five of them, but now come to the very last one and the very last link, which is sort of interesting here. We've just seen what the wisdom faculty is, and then at the very end there, Venerable Sariputta, he says, when a noble disciple has tried again and again, recollected again and again, entered immersion again and again, and understood with wisdom again and again, then they will be confident of this. I have previously heard these things, but now I have direct meditative experience of them. I see them with penetrating wisdom, for the faith is the faculty of faith. So here it just shows you how you, by doing these things over and over, eventually you have these insights. Yeah, you keep on just practicing, attaining samadhi again and again, and as you do so, eventually you have the insight. And what is interesting here is that this takes it back again to the faculty of faith. That insight you have, the wisdom you have, becomes the faith at the very beginning, and it reinforces the very first spiritual faculty. And at that point, they become the real spiritual faculties of the noble person. They become established, and there is no more kind of wavering about them. So again, it shows this connection between wisdom and faith, or wisdom and sadha, panya and sadha, in the Buddhist teachings, which is quite unique, I think, perhaps, to Buddhism, that you have that connection there. So there you are. That is basically the spiritual faculties. And then the Buddha, at the very end, he says, good, Sariputta. Sariputta, a noble disciple who is sure and devoted to the realized one, will have no doubt or uncertainty about the realized one or his instructions. And then he repeats the sutta word for word in the way that Sariputta has already said it. And the idea, of course, is that by repeating it, he's just kind of giving his approval of the teaching. That's really what it is about. So that is how they work. And now I think what is nice to do now is to have a little bit more look at the idea of the faculty of sadha, of faith, what it means in practice, and how we can use it. And I mention this because it is a very important part of the path. As I said before, when you have the sadha faculty, you use it in the right way. It gives rise to the joy and all the enthusiasm and all the inspiration on the path. And it kind of allows the meditation to become really powerful when you have that joy coming up with the meditation practice. So the spiritual faculty of sadha is very useful. So if you're able to kind of access some of that joy through these methods or means that the Buddha is talking about, then the path becomes so much more interesting. It's good to meditate, it's nice to be peaceful, but getting the joy, and that is where it really starts to become very nice and very otherworldly. You start to enter the spiritual realm in a very real sense at that particular point. So there are a number of suttas that talk about this. And one of these suttas is called the Mahanama Sutta, which is the next one from the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourse. And this is the sixes. Numerical discourse are grouped into numbers, each number being the number of items in that sutta. So the sixes is all the suttas with six items, the tenth sutta. Mahanama was the cousin of the Buddha, and there's a nice story in the Vinaya about Mahanama. The story about Mahanama and the Vinaya. This is the story where after the Buddha has gone forth, and all his Sakyan relatives, they think, oh, the Buddha has gone forth, and maybe we should go forth as well, because we are his relatives. And then this one household, these two brothers, Anuruddha and Mahanama, and they are kind of arguing about who should go forth. And Anuruddha says to Mahananda, I've been kind of brought up in such incredible comfort. There's no way that I can go forth because it's too harsh for someone who is as soft as me. something to that effect. That's basically essentially what he's saying here. And then Mahanama says to him, well, if that is the case, I will have to teach you all the chores of the household life so that you can look after them while I go for it. One of us is going to have to go for it. Every family should at least have one son who goes for it, at least among the Sakyans. So he says to Anuruddha, well, you know, it means that in the, because they're all farmers, these people, so you, when the kind of the season is right, you have to go into the field, or you have to plow the field. And after having plowed the field, you have to sow the seeds. And after sowing the seeds, you have to let the water into the seeds. Then you have to drain the water out of the fields. Then you have to weed the fields for all the weeds. When it's all ripe, you have to mow the field. Then you have to kind of take all the straws or whatever, bring them back, and you have to get all the grains out of it, you have to thresh it or whatever it's called, and then you have to winnow it to make sure all the stuff, all the kind of the chaff, etc., goes out. Then you have to store it in the storeroom, and then when it's stored in the storeroom, and then eventually the next season has already come, next season you start all over again. And Anuruddha says, well, what does this mean? Does it mean the work never takes an end? If it starts over again the next season, when is it going to come to an end? When can I just chillax? He doesn't use the word chillax, but you know. When can I just kind of really take it easy? And Mananda, there is no relaxation. It just goes on and on and on. And he says, in the middle of this work, our father and grandfathers and forefathers, they all died in the middle of their work. This is kind of how samsara just carries on forever. And Anuruddha said, well, in that case, you stay at home, I will go forth. It's a very kind of sweet little story. So Anuruddha is trying to get out of the work, whatever best way to get out of the work, and he kindly decides to go forth. And that is the story. So Mahanama is staying in the household life, but he is still very wise, and he ends up becoming a stream mentor. And when the Buddha is visiting Kapilavatthu, he then approaches the Buddha and they have a conversation together. This is the conversation between the Buddha and Mahanama that we find here. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavatthu in the banyan tree park. Then Mahanama, the Sakyan, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to the Blessed One, Pante, how does a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching often dwell? Dwell here, viharati, can also be understood as meditate. How does he often meditate is one way of translating that. You remember that word I talked about today, diva vihara, days abiding. It really means a day's meditation practice. So vihara often has a meaning of meditation, and sometimes it is a synonym for samadhi itself. The noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, this is the sotapanna, who has realized fully with their own insight what the teachings are about. So he's basically saying here, I am a stream entry, I want to know what to do, how to use that to the best benefit. And as always, when you see these teachings, you may think that they are not really relevant if you're not a stream entry, but they still are. It's just that you can't do it quite as fully as a stream entry, but they're still relevant. Some of the ideas are still basically the same for how you practice. So this is what the Buddha says there. Mahanama, a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, often meditates in this way. And he gives six types of meditation. And I've taken out two that I want to talk about, and I will talk about one of the third ones later on. Here, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Tathagata, in other words, the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly awakened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas, of gods and humans, the awakened one, the blessed one. And then it goes on about how that gives rise to joy and all of that if you do it in the right way. So that is the purpose of this. And again, as I mentioned before, this is that very famous verse that we very often chant in Buddhism. Ittipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho, etc. That is that verse there. So this is how the Buddha himself recommends that we should recollect him. So if you think about the Buddha, this is the ideal way. Yeah? And so before I talk about this, because this is kind of the Buddha as the awakened person, I want to continue a little bit on the what I mentioned before about the Buddha being in many ways an ordinary person just like the rest of us. And I always kind of like to say that it's important that we put the Buddha on the right kind of pedestal, not on the God pedestal, but the perfected human being pedestal. And that makes a big difference to put him on the right pedestal, because we should always be respectful, but we should also think about the Buddha in the right way. And in fact, it is far, far more there to respect if you are a perfect human being than if you are a god. If you are like the Christian god, well, you have always been the Christian god. It's not your fault that you became the Christian god. You just happen to be like that always. Yeah, nobody can praise you for being the Christian god. And still, Christians, they go around praising their god as if that god is really kind of has done something marvelous. Actually, it's always been God, always been like that. Hasn't done anything at all. So it's not really all that much to respect. The reason why you respect the Christian god is because you see the Christian god as so powerful. Yeah, so you say, oh, please help me, yeah, big father in the sky, your mother in the sky, because you can sort things out for me. That is why you respect the Christian god. But a Buddha is actually someone who through their own effort and through their own practice has been able to achieve something astonishing. Finding the very meaning of life, finding the end of all suffering, finding happiness, finding the solution to all the problems that everyone is seeking to discover in their life. That is really worthy of something special. Someone who actually has kind of navigated life in a very profound way. The Buddha wasn't born like that. The Buddha is not a god. The Buddha is very different from the god of most other religions, because he has done the practice and discovered this on his own right. To me, that is really worthy of respect. But someone who has always been a god, you know, it doesn't, I don't know, to me it's just, okay, you've always been a god, you know, why should we respect you? You haven't done anything at all, really. Okay, you created the universe, but I mean, so what? You just kind of went bang, you kind of whizzed your little wand and you created the universe. It's not such a big deal. Yeah, actually, that was a big mistake anyway to create the universe. So I'm not sure why we should praise you for that. So anyway, so to me, what the Buddha did, I'm being perhaps a bit facetious and and silly, but to me, the idea of what the Buddha has done is really special and very unique in the way that nothing else really is. So this is one of the reasons we should put the Buddha on the right kind of pedestal to understand what it exactly is that we are respecting. What are we really respecting? Well, what we are respecting is a human being who has been able to take his ordinary human status and then actually have some very special insight into the nature of reality. And that idea that the Buddha is human, it comes out in so many places in the suttas. We have already seen how it comes out in the idea that the Buddha suffers from old age and sickness, just like other people. He has a physical body just like everyone else. The idea that the Buddha can live on for an eon, I think it is one of those things that are not even remotely true, but it destroys some of that naturalistic thing that we see again and again in the suttas. So he has a human body just like us. This is one of those things that make him very human. Second thing is that he has kind of similar problems to what we have as human beings. When he started out on his path, he had, you know, defilements of the mind. He talks about those defilements, specifically how he overcame them. He talks about having difficulties in entering samadhi. Yeah, that's another kind of amazing thing. He talks about all the upakilesas, the refined defilements that get in the way of samadhi practice. He talks about having wrong view. He talks about having to give up his family while his parents are weeping. Yeah, anyone who's become a monk or nun knows what that is like, because that is almost a universal experience. please don't become a monk. Why are you becoming a monk for? And is the last thing we want you to do is become a monk? No, don't go. The Buddha had exactly the same problem. It's kind of these universal aspects of human existence, it seems. So, again, this is something you can relate to. You can really relate to this person called the Buddha in so many ways. He is immersed in the same kind of reality that we are. And that is why his teachings are so relevant to us. He understands us in a very profound sense. There's another aspect with the Buddha which also makes him very human. And that is how he relates to people very often. You may think that the greatest spiritual genius in human history would be someone who is really aloof, who just sits on a high platform. I sit on a very high platform. It's probably embarrassing because the Buddha probably sat much lower than I do. So we kind of... But the Buddha, the way you meet him in the suttas, he would sit at the root of a tree here and probably just have a sitting cloth with him. Yeah, I have exchanged a sitting cloth for this high platform. And he would be very simple, and you go up to him, and then you kind of bow down, and you have this, everything is very straightforward, and you have a very direct and immediate relationship with him. And you see that in a number of places in the suttas. I think I mentioned already when King Pasenadi comes to the Buddha, and he's a bit overweight, and he's huffing and puffing. And the Buddha gives him a kind of a slimming, how to diet. He tells him how to kind of lose weight. This is the world's first weight loss regime. And it comes from the Buddha. Yeah, it comes from it comes from the Buddha. It's astonishing. And of course, the point is that if you are someone who people respect, they will ask you for these questions, yeah? Oh, please, Buddha, how can I lose weight? I'm an arahant, don't you understand? You can't ask questions like this from me. He doesn't say that. He actually gives him, he shows him what to do. This is kind of the remarkable thing. He's very human. And he relates to people in a very natural way. And then there's a really nice example where this is also where King Pasenadi. King Pasenadi comes to the Buddha, and while he's there with the Buddha, this man, one of his attendants or whatever, comes up to King Pasenadi and he whispers in his ear. And then after he has whispered in his ear, King Pasenadi looks down, he looks really glum and sad and doesn't want to look up. And the Buddha asks him, what's the problem? And King Pasenadi said, well, this man who came up to me, he just told me that my favorite wife, Queen Malika, she's given birth to a son. They didn't have ultrasound in those days. They had no idea what the gender was going to be before the baby was born. Just given born to a son. That's why I feel so sad. And then the Buddha says to him, he says that, well, a daughter... my wife has just given birth to a daughter. That's what I wanted to say. Given birth to a daughter. It looks really glum and sad. And then... in India those days, son was what was it was all about. It was all about having a son. Daughters were not really valued. So the Buddha tells him, well, a daughter can turn out better than a son. Yeah, it depends on the character of the person. You can have a good daughter and a bad son. Much better to have a good daughter than to have a bad son. And another kind of very ordinary thing here. But it is also very beautiful in a sense, because it shows you the kind of care for people, the care for individuals. And of course, it's also a very modern kind of outlook, the idea of, if you like, you value people for their character. You don't value them for kind of external things like gender or wealth or intelligence, that kind of stuff. But you value people for their character rather than all of these other superficial things in life. It's also a very modern outlook, which is also very nice. One of my favorite places where the Buddha really kind of acts as one of the ordinary, an ordinary monk in a sense, together with his own monks. Very often the Buddha would walk out in the monastery and he would walk around to the various dwellings and he would see what the monks were up to. Yeah, and sometimes he would not be very impressed. Sometimes he would be impressed. Sometimes he would praise the monk for, yeah, that's good what you're doing. I think that was... what was one occasion when a monk was patching his robes. Yeah, so you get a hole in your robe and then you have a patch on it. I don't have any patches on my robe. I should have a patch on my robe just to be able to show you what it means. I used to have a really patched robe, but not anymore. So this monk was patching his robe and the Buddha praised him for patching his robe. That is the way a monastic should act. You should kind of look after the cloth. You should patch it and keep it a long time. And then he walks around the monastery like this, and on one of these occasions when he's walking around, he comes to this hut, and in this hut there is a monk lying there, and he's very sick. And he has dysentery here. And dysentery is an illness where kind of everything kind of comes out of you, flows out of you. You're really filthy and just lie there and you're kind of all your feces and urine, all this kind of stuff. Really disgusting illness. And the Buddha asks him, well, how come you have no attendant? Yeah, you're in this terrible state. How come you have no attendant? And then this monk says, well, I don't have an attendant because I don't do anything for the monks, so the monks don't do anything for me. And then the Buddha is not too impressed when he hears that. And the Buddha says to Venerable Ananda, get some water. And then the two of them clean up this monk. They wash him down, put on some nice new robes, lift him up. The Buddha takes him by the head, Ananda by the feet, lift him up and put him on the bed. Yeah, this is the Buddha. Yeah, and this is kind of, it's so different from how we normally think about the spiritual master. He's really kind of doing the dirty work in this particular case. Kind of astonishing. And of course afterwards, obviously there's many reasons why the Buddha does that by way of example. But also I think it's just his general humanity. Yeah, the Buddha helps people, even though he is the leader of the entire community. Then he goes out and he meets all the monks. And he says to the monks, what is that monk in that cuti over there? Oh, he's a sick monk. Well, what kind of sickness does he have? Oh, he has dysentery. Well, how come he doesn't have an attendant? Because he doesn't do anything for us. And then the Buddha tells the monks, he says to them, you have no mother and father. If you are not going to look after each other, who is going to look after you? And then he says to the monks that anyone who would look after me should look after each other. And this is kind of the Buddha talking to the monks and making sure that they kind of do things in the right way. You should prioritize each other as much as you prioritize looking after me. Very powerful statement. And one of those very beautiful instances in the suttas where the Buddha kind of acts almost as if he's a normal monk and part of the community. So, those are just some of the stories, and there are many more as well in the suttas that you find, and you see the Buddha in normal interaction, and he comes across as a normal human being. From all of that, you realize the Buddha is a human being. In fact, the pedestal of a normal human being that is perfected should be taller than the pedestal for God. Yeah? God pedestal is over there, perfected human being is over there, it's much higher. Why? Because it's far more impressive. And we will see this in a second, because the Buddha calls himself the teacher of gods and humans. One of those powerful examples of Buddha being teacher of gods and humans is the example in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26, where after the Buddha's awakening, Brahma Sahampati comes down to the Buddha and asks the Buddha to teach so the world does not perish. The Buddha has the answer that everyone is looking for. What is the symbolism of that? It's very powerful, because Brahma Sahampati, he is like the god in the Brahmanical teaching. He's like Brahma. Yeah, he's the creator of the universe he's like the Christian god, basically, the creator of the universe. Or the universal consciousness or principle or whatever you want to call it. The way the Hindus look at Brahma, apparently many different ways, depending on how you look at many different ways of understanding Brahma. And then what happens? Brahma comes down to the Buddha, bows down to the Buddha, please teach. Yeah? This is kind of the highest God in the universe. And that's why I'm saying, God is here, the Buddha is kind of here. Yeah? This is kind of the Buddhist view of this. Don't tell, are there any Christians here? I should have asked this first. Too late. Cat is out of the bag. Oops.
You should be comparing the Buddha and Jesus rather than God. Jesus actually came and he was one of the people.
Okay. Maybe I should, I don't know. But it's just interesting, the idea with Brahma, because that Brahma also comes down. And Brahma has this kind of, coming down in this way. But Jesus, that's true, because Jesus also is the kind of the coming down of God, isn't it, in a sense? So the similar kind of situation. Yeah. Right. That's a good point. Okay. Anyway. So I'm being a bit naughty, but it's good fun, because the Buddhist point of view is quite different from the point of view of other religions. So when you see that, you get a kind of different feeling for these things. Anyway, let us leave it at that, because that is just the kind of the worldly side of the Buddha, and of course that is all quite interesting in many ways, but what really makes the Buddha interesting, of course, is the kind of the fact that he is the human being perfected. That is what makes the Buddha special and what makes it interesting here. So what I want to look at now are these qualities that are mentioned in the sutta, the qualities that the Buddha himself recommends, what makes him a Buddha. So these are kind of the flip side of being a human being, that you are a human being perfected. So let us have a look at these things in turn and just discuss them briefly. First of all, you have the Blessed One is an arahant. And the idea of arahant is a word that existed in India prior to the advent of Buddhism. In those days it just meant a perfected human being. So any religion, they would have arahants around. And then it was a word that was used by the Buddha and applied then to his teaching to refer to a perfected human being. The translation used sometimes is the perfected is one of the translations used for arahant. But the actual root meaning of the word is worthy. The worthy one, a worthy person. You are worthy in the sense that because you are a perfected spiritual master, you are worthy of a special honor, or respect, and all of these kind of things, because you have access to a truth that is beyond ordinary human beings. You are a teacher of the highest caliber, and that is what makes you worthy of all the special offerings and respect and all of these kind of things. So this is an important element of this idea of arahant. And as always, these words, they get a special meaning in Buddhism, a meaning that is the original word may be derived from the Indian culture, but then gets rewritten with a special meaning in Buddhism. Then you have the perfectly enlightened or perfectly awakened, Sambuddha. Awakening is just really an understanding of truth, an insight into reality, a kind of waking up from a dream almost, or at least a waking up from delusion. And often we talk about delusion in Buddhism, and being deluded is a bit like being confused and not really in control, and your mind is kind of seeing things upside down. The awakening is setting upright that which was overturned, turning on the light for one in the dark, etc. So the idea of awakening is an important one in Buddhism. Enlightenment is not wrong either, but enlightenment, it kind of suggests that the light gets turned on, and the idea of the light getting turned on, being in the dark beforehand and now seeing things according to reality, actually is one of the metaphors used throughout the suttas for the awakening experience. So enlightenment is actually, in some ways, it's okay. The problem with that word is that it suggests kind of the age of enlightenment, the kind of age after the dark ages or middle ages in Europe, when kind of people started to kind of look at science again, take science seriously, called the age of enlightenment in European history, and that kind of misses the point dramatically. So in some ways, the idea of awakening is better because it is also the immediate meaning of the word Buddha. Bujjati means to awake. You wake up in the morning, Buddha. You are Buddha already. That's the kind of lower kind of Buddha. And then we strive for the higher kind of Buddha, the higher kind of awakening. Accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, vijja charana sampanno. And here we have this idea of vijja again. And the idea of vijja is the idea of understanding reality. If there's any word perhaps that can be translated in the suttas as insight, this word can certainly be translated as insight. These are, if you like, the three kinds of insight that you have. The te vijja is what is known as the insights in the suttas. It comes from the Brahmanical idea of three insights, and the Buddha again takes that idea and applies it to Buddhism. It is, again, as I said before, is related to many Indo-European words, related to the English word wit, related to the German word wissen, which also means science. and etc., etc. It's a kind of one of these Indo-European words, te vidya. So if anything can be translated as insight, this is actually a good candidate for that. Usually we translate the word vipassana as insight, but it is not clear that vipassana should be translated as insight, because insight really in English means a moment of sudden seeing. Bam! You have an insight into something. And it is very close in meaning to panya in Pali, wisdom arising. Wisdom comes like a flash. Yeah, suddenly you see, suddenly you have an insight into something. It changes your psychology. You look at the world in a new way. Yeah? And these things here, they are a bit like that. They are like flashes. They are real insights in the sense of giving rise to deep wisdom. Yeah? But the word vipassana is more like something that is a gradual thing that happens gradually, and it is something that carries on the path gradually. It can also be a flash, but it's much more than that. It's a gradual clearing up of the mind, seeing things more clearly. It's just like samatha. Samatha is a gradual improvement in the calm of the mind, becoming more peaceful. And then the samadhi are the states of calm, specific states. In the same way, vipassana is the gradual clear seeing. It always goes together with samatha in the suttas. And the panya, the wisdom, is that flash that comes when you see things. And so this is an important distinction. And it says specifically in the suttas that vipassana is what leads to panya. So if you keep on having vipassana, eventually it leads to that understanding and wisdom that is the panya. So that is a subtle thing, and I remember discussing that with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi once, because it is one of those things that when you do a bit of a translation, you discuss these terms, and I suggested to him that maybe vipassana would be better to translate it as clear seeing rather than insight. And to my surprise, he agreed with me. That was kind of a surprise. But he said he didn't want to change the translation because it had become an accepted translation. Vipassana kind of was accepted as insight. So even though he sort of agreed with what I was saying, he had still decided to keep the old translation as it was. So what can you say then? You can't really, that's the end of the argument really. But it's interesting because sometimes you think when you read the suttas in English, you may think that you understand what is going on, but really the only way to fully understand what is going on is sometimes, actually not that often, most of the time you can rely on the English translation a long way, but sometimes you have to go back to the Pali to get the full understanding of what is going on. Don't worry, you don't have to learn Pali to read the suttas, but I'm just saying that occasionally it can be helpful to know a bit of Pali just to take you all the way back to the most a basic source for these teachings. So what are these te vidyas? And the te vidyas, of course, in Buddhism is the recollection of rebirth, the understanding, the recollection of past life, seeing rebirth, seeing the laws of karma, and then the final awakening experience of the arahant. These are the te vidyas. These can be called the three insights, if you like. Yeah. So this is kind of the final, the real awakening, the real understanding that ultimately matters in Buddhism. These three things are always mentioned together in the suttas, and they, as I mentioned before, with the simile of the chick coming out of the shell, it shows you how important these insights actually are. These are the real, real discoveries on the Buddhist path of these three insights. Because these are the things that changes your outlook so dramatically as a consequence. So what is also interesting about this, here it says, it talks about vidya charana sampanno, endowed with both insight and also with conduct. And the idea is that when you have a real insight that changes your mental outlook, it affects your conduct. You change the way you are, the way you look at, the way you treat other people, the way you behave. Why? Because your psychology, your inner life has changed, and that will always come out in how you behave as a person. So if you have no anger, and you have no desires anymore, you have no delusion, you have the exact opposite. One of the things to kind of be clear about is that when you take away all the defilements, it is not just like an empty hole that is left behind. Because it doesn't sound all that inspiring. Yeah, the defilements are gone. You think, yes, so what? Big deal. The defilements, yeah, sounds kind of boring. If I've gotten the defilements, it sounds kind of flat. Maybe life doesn't really have any interest after that. But of course, the point is, when you remove the defilements, what happens is that all the opposite qualities come to the fore and they become very powerful. That is really the point. So take away the ill will and you become very compassionate and kind. Yeah, it is not, you don't just become like completely equanimous and even-minded and kind of treat everyone completely indifferently. That is not what happens. It's the other qualities that come out. Take away the desires and the selfishness, you become immensely generous. Yeah, because you don't think about yourself anymore because you know that that's just a pain anyway. Thinking about yourself, what does that do? It kind of makes you small, makes you afraid of the world outside because the world outside is going to rip you off. The world outside is dangerous. If you're trying to amass things and hold on to them in a selfish way, the world outside looks dangerous because it may take away your things. But if you don't have that anymore and you're willing to share everything with the world, you have this expansive mind that always wants to share with everyone else, always is willing to give of what you have, whatever that might be, especially your wisdom in this particular context. This is the effect of abandoning the defilements, yeah? That it has this opposite effect. Abandon restlessness, you become very peaceful. Abandon the tiredness and lethargy to a large extent, and you become very clear-minded, you don't have any tiredness anymore. Abandon the doubt, you become very clear about things, you become very confident, not confident in an egocentric kind of way, but a natural confidence that just comes from having direct knowledge of what you're talking about, and that is really what the Buddha is. So when you see a Buddha, you can expect to see something special. You can expect to see someone who is kind of and not only the Buddha, but anyone who is an arahant, or even lower Aryas, you might see a little bit of these things. You see something that is special. You see something that is not normal to see in human beings. And you see it consistently. You see it consistently because once these defilements have gone, then it can't come back again. So it's consistently there. And this is one of the things that makes it possible to know that these teachings are still alive in the world. If it didn't change our conduct when someone becomes an Arya, then there would be no way of knowing. Yeah, people would be noble ones, but you wouldn't be able to tell. But the very fact that it comes out in in people's external conduct means that there is a way of telling whether people are noble ones in this world. So this is kind of the point of this. So if you watch carefully, if you're honest, if you investigate carefully, you should be able sometimes to tell, get some confidence that these things are still done in the world. They still happen. That is such a wonderful thing to be able to see that sometimes. Sometimes you meet exceptional people, and I have met some of these exceptional people in my life, and I think, wow, what a wonderful thing it is. What a wonderful example these people are to humanity, to other Buddhists, to the practice and everything else. It really inspires confidence in these teachings. This is what happened. And sometimes people, it's very strange, sometimes people have confidence in kind of strange places. I never really understood that. This idea of crazy wisdom that you sometimes hear about in Buddhism. In my opinion, either you're crazy or you're wise. You're not both at the same time. Crazy wisdom is an oxymoron. You don't kind of go around hitting people and doing bad things and you're an arahant at the same time. It doesn't work like that. If you're an arahant, you are kind. You're not kind of, you don't do harsh things to others. So that is the idea of true knowledge and conduct. Then you have the idea of fortunate, Sugato, translated as the Holy One in the sutta by Bhante Sujato. Sugato literally means one who is gone, well gone. And it can refer maybe to, maybe it could translate as the happy one. That's been a suggestion I've had before. I'm not sure. The happy one. Why? Because you have gone to a good destination. It means you're happy. So that is one possibility. But it is really just another epithet of the Buddha, and it's very difficult to know exactly how it was understood in ancient India, because the meaning has kind of got a bit blurred by 2,500 years. But something like that. Knower of the world, Loka Vidu, another one of the important ways of describing the Buddha. Knower of the world can be understood in a number of different ways. It obviously means things like understanding rebirth, understanding all the ways that you get reborn in different places. Maybe it means understanding the universe. Maybe it means understanding the world of humanity, understanding the various kinds of religions and sects and whatever there is, and understanding how all of these various theories, how they come out and what they are based on, how they compare to the Dhamma, and all of this. This is kind of understanding the world. But the main thing really with this, and the reason why the idea of rebirth is so important to understand, because it's a similar kind of thing, the main thing about this, the main insight that this relates to, is the idea of happiness and suffering. Yeah, and because one thing is to understand the happiness and suffering that is you can have in human existence, but if there is such a thing as rebirth, you need to know everything that there is to know about happiness and suffering. If you are going to make a decision on where happiness is to be found, where suffering is to be found, and to understand it fully, you have to know the full scope of happiness and suffering. So what it really means, the idea of understanding rebirth, understanding the various rebirths you can have, understanding the path that leads there, is really just to have a full understanding of samsaric happiness and suffering. Without knowing that, you can't have the full picture of what happiness and suffering is. So you may wonder, some of people wonder, how can I relate to the happiness or suffering of beings born in a different realm? How can that make any sense to me? And it actually is not that hard to make sense of these things. And I will just briefly just mention how I like to think about this. In the human realm, you already have a kind of a wide variety of happiness and suffering. You have people who live in very poor, difficult circumstances, who maybe don't have any education, they're very poor, they are sickly, maybe they live in a violent situation in the war zone or something like that. And then you have the opposite end of things, people who are kind of wealthy and live in a good place, in a good country, where you have good social services and you are intelligent, got a good education, or whatever. There's a big difference in humanity. Then you have all the people in between. And then thinking about other realms is just an extension of that difference that is already there. Instead of stopping at the poorest, most kind of destitute person, you go further down, much, much way below that, into a much worse situation. If you take the person in the best possible position in this planet, you just take it way beyond that. And that is kind of how you extend this idea. So it's really just an extension of what we have already here. It is interesting, in the suttas, the word deva is usually used to mean a god. But the kings are also called devas. Yeah? If you talk to a king, you call them deva. It means like lord or sir or something like that. So it is already there, you can see the connection between the devas as gods and the human beings at the higher realms. There's a similar connection because the movement is in the same direction towards a higher degree of happiness, a higher kind of existence. So that is really all it is. So you can imagine if you die, if you get reborn in a Devaloka, what does that feel like? Does it feel alien or strange? No, it doesn't. Suddenly you're just there. Oops, Deva. I'm a Deva. Okay, that's quite nice. Yeah, it's pretty cool to be a Deva. You've got this kind of light, nice body. It's not as heavy as this human body. It's kind of nice and maybe bright, maybe a bit translucent. You can fly through the air, just kind of bang, move here, go there. Wow, I can fly through the air. I couldn't do that before. I'm going to put this heavy human body. Maybe you have much more happiness, much more enjoyment. You go to the Nandana Grove. The Nandana Grove is where the devas go to enjoy themselves. You hang out in the Nandana Grove, listen to deva music. I don't think it's harp music. It must be much better than that. I don't believe it's harp music. Must be, I don't know what it is. What is, probably, I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to get going there. Some kind of nice, so you enjoy yourself and whatever. And that's how we are a deva. Or if you have not lived so well, you get reborn, you find yourself to become a ghost. Oops, I'm a ghost. Oh no, that's a bummer. I've become a ghost. That is really bad. And then you suddenly find yourself being a ghost, and you wander around in a kind of miserable ghost realm. Everything is really kind of not very nice. It is not as bad as the animal realm. The animal realm is even worse, but it's not nice to be reborn as a ghost. Yeah, you get a little bit of meager food. You're always kind of a little bit hungry. You can never find enough food. The sun is really hot, and the trees don't give much shade. That kind of stuff. That's kind of the ghost realm for you. It's pretty miserable. And you think, oh no, why did I do those bad deeds? Now I have to wander around as a ghost. So I hope my relatives do something good for me, so I get some good merit, and I can rejoice in their good actions. Please, children, you know, please do something nice for me, so I can get some good merits. And this is how the ghost realm, what the ghost realm is like. It's bad news to be reborn in the ghost realm. But remember, it is just you continuing. Yeah? There you are. You suddenly find yourself being a ghost. So this is what it is. It is nothing really kind of astonishing about it. It is just you carrying on in a new way. So this is what the Buddha sees. He sees the whole potential for suffering and happiness in the universe. Every kind of possible rebirth, how you get there. He understands how impermanent it is, how unreliable, how there is no way you can go to a corner of the universe and hang out there forever after. It doesn't work like that. Before you know it, you get reborn somewhere else. Before you know it, you're no longer a Buddhist. You become influenced by some terrorist, and you start doing terrorist activities. Yeah, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, to want to do terrorist activities, but it could happen to any one of us. The wrong influence, the wrong kind of conditioning, and you can do whatever anyone else can do with this universe. And this is how you start to have compassion for the people who do really bad things, because you know everyone has the potential to do crazy things. Given the right, or maybe we say the wrong circumstances, it can happen to each one of us. So this is kind of, it's a beautiful way of thinking, because it gives rise to more compassion, understanding, even for people who do terrible things in this world. So when the Buddha sees all of this, and he weighs it all up, this is what it means, full understanding of human happiness and suffering. And then that is where he can make the decision what to do. Is it really worthwhile or not? And of course the Buddha realizes there's a whole heap of problems, whole heap of suffering. So his mind leans towards the exit from all of that, and he makes therefore an end of samsara, and then discovers the ending of all suffering as a consequence. Only when you know, have full understanding of what is going on, can you make that decision on what should be done as a consequence. So this is the Buddha's insight, yeah? Understanding everything there is to know about happiness and suffering in samsaric existence. And of course, that is incredibly significant. If you look at human life, or animal life, or ghost life, or deva life, or any kind of life, everything that drives us is based on our feelings. It is based on happiness and suffering, how we can achieve maximum happiness in our life, how we can avoid suffering in our life. Everything is based on that. That's why you come here to Dharma Grove. Yeah, you come here to hopefully find some peace of mind and find some spiritual happiness or whatever. That's why I teach these suttas, because I think this is going to be good for me. If I did, maybe also because I want to be, you know, hopefully people also enjoy these things. But it is always based on this idea that it will lead us somewhere positive. If you look at what everything we do in our life, from the short-term things, such as what are you going to eat at your next meal, or what are you going to dress like, or what are you going to, entertainment you're going to watch, or to the long-term decisions in life, where you're going to live, how you're going to be educated, what kind of religion you choose. Everything, absolutely everything, is driven by these feelings that we have. We want to move towards more happiness and away from suffering. If it wasn't for that, life would be completely meaningless. Feelings are the thing that gives life meaning, and the drive, the craving, the drive, the desire. So if the Buddha has understood everything about that, then he has understood everything there is to be understood about life itself. Once you understand happiness and suffering fully, you also fully understand the very meaning of life, because that is what gives life meaning. That is what drives us to do everything we do in this existence. And this is how you can see why the Buddha actually has discovered the meaning of life, because he has discovered this source of our drives, our desires and cravings and absolutely everything here. So Lokavidura is a very important thing, and that is what it comes down to, the understanding of happiness and suffering here. Then the Buddha is said to be the unsurpassed trainer of tameable people. People who are tameable, they are people who have an interest in the spiritual life, they are tameable. If you are no interest in the spiritual life, you cannot be tamed. Then you are, there is nothing that can happen. You are unsurpassed tamer, trainer of these people. Why are you unsurpassed? Well, first of all, you are unsurpassed because you have the highest wisdom. You fully understand happiness and suffering. Everyone in the world, ultimately, they want to know what you have discovered. They may not realize that sometimes, but really, that's what they want, because you have understood the very foundation of what life is about. This is why you are the highest kind of teacher, because you have the highest insight. But you also have the highest insight because he has compassion. And this is one of those things that is so fascinating about the Buddha, is that when the Buddha's after his awakening, all the Buddha probably wants to do is just to kind of, sit down, enter deep states of meditation, do that until the day he passes away, because that is where a Buddha or an Arahant finds the highest happiness, in the deep meditations of the jhanas and deep samadhis. But instead of doing that, he decides he's going to share his discovery with humanity here. He's going to wander around the planet for 45 years to all kinds of different locations, and then teach people, because he knows that they are desperate to find these answers that he has discovered. And there's something very beautiful about that. The Buddha gives up, to some extent, his own happiness so he can give help other people. There is nothing for the Buddha to be gained by teaching others. He doesn't gain anything because he doesn't really want to be around people. He doesn't want to have to teach others because it just takes away from his own peace and his own happiness in a way. He does it simply out of compassion, because he wants to be helpful, because he wants to share what he has discovered with humanity. And that is very very interesting, because what it means is that when the Buddha teaches the suttas, he teaches it from an incredible high degree of purity. There is no vested interest. He doesn't get anything out of it. He only teaches things because he knows it is going to be for the benefit of his listeners. So the teachings are very pure. There's nothing in there to flatter the ego of his audience. If you are a teacher and maybe you depend on the income that the students give you, or your livelihood depends somehow on being a teacher, you might kind of say things that kind of help that to come about, somehow. Whatever it is, most teachers, they have some vested interest in what is going on when they teach. It is very difficult to teach completely without vested interest. And whenever there's a vested interest, because you teach in a certain way, maybe to affect the audience a little bit, or to have some kind of influence, it means that the teaching is a little bit compromised as a consequence. It is compromised by that vested interest. But when there's no vested interest, there is like a negative vested interest, because the Buddha would rather do something else, it is going to be very pure. And all you see there is only not to impress anybody, not to manipulate anyone, not to make anyone do anything in particular. It is only out of compassion. And when you think like that, you start reading the word of the Buddha, you start to look at it in a different way, because you take it on board in a way whereby you know that this is spoken purely in your and everyone's best interest, and for no other reason. So these little thoughts like that make these teachings come much more alive. They are the most profound wisdom about happiness and suffering, and there is no vested interest. They are purely motivated by compassion and nothing else. So this is what makes the Buddha such a powerful teacher. There is another thing that I always like to point out about these teachings that also make the Buddha a very special teacher. And that is the fact that when the Buddha started teaching 2,500 years ago, he set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. So he knew that he was starting this wheel of the Dhamma, and that because he specifically says that, yeah, in that sutta, the wheel of the Dhamma is set in motion. Huh? So he knew that he was starting this thing here, that would go down from one generation to the next, from one culture to the next, from one country to the next, from one century to the next, passed on from person to person, teacher to student, and on and on and on. He knew that because he probably knew that these teachings would be irresistible once they were kind of given out into the world. And because he knew that, he taught in a way that was not just relevant for the audience in front of him. Of course, the audience in front of him was maybe the primary students, but he taught in a way that he gave a universal message that was equally applicable and equally useful for anyone in the world, because he knew this wheel of the Dhamma would roll out into the world for so long into the future. So he knew, yeah, there would be people down the centuries, he knew that there were people in other cultures, he knew that there would be, maybe, he knew in a sense that there would be people in Jhana Grove, yeah, listening to his teachings 2,500 years later. Not specifically, but he knew it by implication. And because of that, he gave these teachings in such a way, he gave them a universal feel to them, that anyone is able to actually understand what is going on. And when you think like that, you are actually a direct disciple of the Buddha. Because the Buddha thought of us when he gave these teachings 2,500 years ago. He thought about the future. He thought about people in different cultures. He thought about us. So remember that when you read these teachings, the Buddha is actually thinking about you. Yeah, you are part of his audience. When he gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he specifically thought about anyone who was interested in these teachings in the future. So when you read these teachings, you are the disciple of the Buddha in a very immediate sense, because you were already the intended recipient of these teachings 2,500 years ago. Think like that, and it kind of makes these things far more alive. Yeah, these are not some dead things that were taught to other people 2,500 years ago. They are intended recipients, are still alive in the present day. Yeah? So these ways of thinking just make the suttas come alive. They're taught out of compassion. We are all the intended recipients of these teachings. They have the highest kind of wisdom that is possible for humanity, because they really see what every one of us wants. And thinking like this makes these things come alive, and they make give you a feeling for who the Buddha was as a person. So, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teachers of devas and humans. Yeah, and again, the idea here is that the Buddha, teachers of devas and humans, very often we think of gods as if they may have a lot of wisdom and insight, but very often they don't. You just get reborn in a higher realm because you have a little bit of wisdom, because you have obviously lived well or whatever. But just because you are kind of powerful and splendiferous doesn't mean that necessarily you have any wisdom. It just means that you're powerful and full of splendor. That's really all it means. It doesn't necessarily mean you have any wisdom. I'm not going to get into that story. It's getting too late for those stories now. But it is true, yeah? So sometimes we get blinded by the splendor of things. You have some kind of insight. Maybe you see a god or something like that. Sometimes you hear people saying they have seen a deva in their meditation, or they have seen some god figure, or you may hear the Christians arguing that they have seen God, and all of these things can very often be similar kind of visions. You have seen something, and you're blinded by the splendor of it. And because you're blinded by the splendor, you forget to ask whether that being really is wise or not. But wait a minute, are you wiser? You may be astonishing, amazing, you look really kind of remarkable, but have you got any wisdom? And they probably would say yes, yeah, so then you are back to square one. But the point is that just because something is amazing and marvelous doesn't mean that there is any wisdom there. So this is what the Buddha is kind of the point here. The Buddha says that this wisdom inside I have attained is at the top of the hierarchy. You can't have any more profound insight into the nature of the human condition that what I have attained. So that's why the gods often do become disciples of the Buddha. Yeah, like Sakya, for example, is supposed to have been a stream entrainer. So if you get reborn in the Tavatingsa heaven, one of these heavenly realms, you get a stream entry for your boss. It's pretty good. People always complain about the bosses. Oh, my boss, oh, so hard. Now you get the stream entry for a boss. Now you can't complain anymore. Huh? And if you still have problems with your boss, maybe you have to reappraise what the problem really is. So this happens sometimes. Anyway, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, yeah, the awakened one, Buddha, the blessed one, the Bhagava. Bhagava is this Indian word that means, is often applied to gods and very highly spiritual attained beings. So the Buddha, of course, being one of these, he is called the Bhagava. And that is the word you have there. So that is the idea of the Buddha. And the idea that the Buddha, how he says we should think about it. And if you think about the Buddha in this way, then all of these things coming next should ideally happen as a consequence. It is may not always happen, but sometimes they do. We'll get back to that tomorrow, because now we are running out of time, unfortunately. So that is all for now. We will continue as usual at 7:30 this evening. So we'll see you back again then.